There's a lot to say when buying a new home or car, but only one thing to say that can help you protect them. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. And just like that, a State Farm agent will be there to help you choose the coverage you need, no matter where you are in life. When you need coverage options, your State Farm agent is there to help, on the phone or in person. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 879. This episode is brought to you by Audible. Audible has the best audiobook performances, unmatched selection, the most exclusive content. Say, maybe you want something sci-fi-y. How about The Martian Chronicles, Ray Bradbury? You could have that. Narrated by Mark Boyette. You could listen to it right now. I mean, after this podcast. But then you could listen to it. Audible will, you know, instead of filling your head with the same music you listen to over and over again, listen to an audiobook after you listen to a podcast. Listen to an audiobook. It'll be available on all your devices, synced up exactly where you left it off. Whatever it is, start a 30-day trial and your first audiobook is free. Learn more at audible.com/nerdist. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. First of all, ID10T Festival is this weekend in Silicon Valley. There's panels, you know, we got a con man panel with Nathan Fillion and Alan Tudyk. We have Harmontown. We have Mystery Science Theater, Portlandia, The Magicians, Animaniacs, Futurama. Jesus, people, what do you want? Then comedy, music. We have Weezer, OK Go, a lot of amazing comedy, Dimitri Martin, Nikki Glaser. So come on down, and there's a Comic-Con at the center of it. So see a lot of local artists, crafters, makers all down at the Shoreline Amphitheater. Saturday and Sunday, June 24 and 25 in Mountain View, California. Go to id10tfest.com for tickets and info. I will see you up there. Also, Will Vega writes, after hearing Chris speak so passionately and often about the virtues of pursuing one's dream in an internet age, I've decided to make a push to expand my online store, Camp Kitsch Press, which is campkitschpress.com. That's K-I-T-S-C-H. I design nerdy, kitschy label lapel pins, patches, hats, shirts. Started as a hobby, but now he's decided to throw his hat in the ring full time. Good for you, and give it a legitimate go. If anything if anyone sees anything they like on the site, use the Nerdist discount NerdistCC, and then I'll get 20% off their entire order. Very nice, Will, throwing a little offer code in there. Also, Kevin writes, I'm a self-described geek who got my pilot's license about a year ago. Chris and company inspired me to make a thing. The thing is Aviator Geek Channel on YouTube. Watch as I share what I learned about my new passion, aviatorgeek.com. I'm so proud of all of you. Making your thing. Making it happen. Not settling for crap. Just going out and being happy. Pursuing joy. I'm very proud of you. This episode is Sofia Coppola. Speaking of pursuing joy, I adore her work. And The Beguiled is a fantastic, super fucked up movie in a great way. It's in theaters June 23rd. And, you know, I'm actually, we tell a story on this episode. Sometimes they'll do corrections in magazines. This is a pre-correction, I suppose. So I tell a story and you'll hear it, but Jason Schwartzman told me a story off the podcast about how he gave he ordered these books and he gave them to Colin Farrell, and Colin Farrell's in The Beguiled, and I couldn't remember what the books were. So this is the correction in the podcast. I say I think it was The Beatles or something. No, it was a Morrissey and Me and then a T-Rex biography. So, you know, when that time comes, you'll go, okay, good. Now I'm just saving the trouble of tweeting at me and going, oh, that's not what it is, Chris, if you somehow knew that. See The Beguiled in theaters, June 23rd. Huge honor to have Sofia Coppola on. We recorded this podcast at my house just about a week and a half ago. Oh, and also, here's how cool she was. Lydia put a guest book in the guest bathroom when you first come into the house, and Sofia Coppola signed the guest book in the bathroom, which I thought was very sweet. So there you go. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 879, also brought to you by Stamps.com. Of course. Avoid the hassle. Don't go to the post office. Stop torturing yourself. Stamps.com lets you buy and print official U.S. postage for anything that you want to mail, any letter, package, class of mail. Click print, mail, you're done. Unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. you know, like they don't close a minute early and you get there at like 4:59 and they're you know, spiritually flipping you off as they're like dropping the blinds on the thing. Does not happen on the internet. So they're going to send you a digital scale that calculates the exact postage you need. They're going to help you decide the best class for whatever you need to mail. And then they're going to bring all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Right now you can enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. But listen to the Nerdist podcast now with Sofia Coppola, number 879. Katie, please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah, I don't know. My Lydia put that in there, and I don't know when that got. I was in there, and honestly, I've never opened it. I don't know if I would sign. Maybe I probably would.
That's so funny.
I would put something in there if I were at someone's house. Thanks for coming to the house.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. I know this is somewhat. It's kind of informal. It's really.
Nice. Yeah.
It's not really like a studio. I still feel like a lot of the time the podcast feels like, hey, I'm recording this in my mom's basement. You know, because it's very low. It's very lo-fi. Are you in the midst of Beguiled Press tour?
I am. It's been nonstop. We shot it last fall in New Orleans. And then we've been editing it and got it finished in time for Cannes, and now it's coming out. So it's all been kind of compressed, and so it's exciting that it's coming out.
And is there any part of the process that you particularly enjoy or don't enjoy? This of just the inception to the shooting to the editing and then all the press stuff, because it's a lot of different things to have to get your brain set for.
Yeah, I find the writing the hardest part, and the shooting is probably the most exciting because you're working with actors and you're all on location and stressful. But I enjoy editing because it's just me and the editor, and the movie starts to take shape, hopefully.
Yeah.
And then the promo part is probably the weirdest because talking about yourself all the time gets a little strange.
Do you ever, but now that you've done this so many times, when you're shooting something, you go, oh, I better remember that story because I'm going to be on a couch or an interview and someone's going to go, what's a crazy thing that happened?
No, the shoot's always a blur. And then someone asks you for an anecdote and you're like, I can't think because it's just all a blur.
We were focused on making the
thing.
Yeah,
I think we're in such a – yeah, so focused just to get everything done. And we had a it was a short shoot, so we had a lot to do.
What was the shooting schedule?
We shot it in 26 days.
Oh, my God.
Which is pretty intense. And but luckily, it all was in one location. Or we shot in two places.
It is. It's like a really beautiful play. I saw it. I got to see it.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, that's what I liked about it, is that it was just so focused and kind of claustrophobic. And it just about these characters. And I liked that it all took place in one setting.
Yeah. I had no idea that there was a 1971 Beguiled movie.
Really?
And I mean, did you find this movie and go, oh, I want to do that? Or did someone bring it to you? How did you arrive at it?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of a classic for people that really know movies, but I had never seen it. I didn't know anything about it. And, Anne, my production designer who, worked on this film, and my friend said, oh, she saw the movie and she said, I think you need to see this movie. I think you need to make a new version of it. And I was like, well, you know, what are you talking about? This Don Siegel kind of his art movie. So I watched it not knowing anything about it. And I was so surprised by the turn of events,
right,
and what happens. I didn't expect it at all. It just stayed in my mind. And I thought it was so weird and such a great premise, about, you know, a group of women and Southern women, and they take in an enemy soldier and all the sexual repression and the heat of the South. And I've always found the South to be very exotic, because it's so different than how I grew up. And so then I started thinking about it, and I found the book that it was based on, which was out of print, and started thinking about how to adapt it. I tried to forget about the movie and just say, how would I adapt this story? Because I just loved the story.
Right. I mean, I know Virgin Suicides was a book, but have you ever Have you ever done anything else that was adapted from another thing?
Yeah, when I did Marie Antoinette, it was based on the Antonia Fraser book.
Right.
But I've done both original and adaptation, and I enjoy adapting a book because it gives you something to work from. You don't have that panic of the blank page.
Right.
You
know? Right. Yeah, it is kind of funny that they I was doing a panel yesterday that Neil deGrasse Tyson was on, and he said the worst direction you can give an engineer is just do whatever you want. You know, like they go, I need something to hold on to.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always that moment, which I'm about to approach, when you finish something, you're like, now what do I do? I can do anything, you know?
Right.
It's nice to have some kind of framework, and adapting a book is enjoyable because it's like a puzzle. Like, how do you turn this book into a movie, which I enjoy.
Right. Do you have sort of like a list in the back of your head of like, okay, now I want to do this. Like, you know, just something that you've been holding on to for like decades.
Yeah, I don't. I have one story that an original I was kind of thinking about when I was starting to work on this. So I'm thinking I will try to go back to that. But I don't know. I don't have. I've always heard Woody Allen has a drawer of tons of ideas. I don't have that drawer.
I think his brain just never shuts off. And yeah. It's just like he just needs to silence the voices. Like, I'll just write this. I'll just deal with you later.
Yeah.
So now that you're done with this, you go through this process, your press is probably a couple of weeks, the movie comes out June 23rd, mm-hmm. I guess. And then do you take a break?
Yes.
You do? Okay, good.
Yes. Good. I'm really looking forward to summer vacation with my kids. I have two daughters. And so, yeah, I'm looking forward to.
And are they teenagers or?
7 and 10.
Oh, 7 and 10. Okay. Yeah. Oh, they're just about to get to that place where they don't want to listen to what you have to say.
It's the last few moments where they maybe want to hang out with me.
Exactly.
I want to be present for that. Enjoy spending time with them while they still hang out with me.
You can still buy them clothes and they don't go, what is this?
The little one, the 7-year-old, but the 10-year-old, I've kind of passed that.
You passed that already.
And I tell her, you know, people actually think that, you know, like I work in fashion. I know about fashion. And she's like, really? Like, yeah. She does not want to hear my input in clothes.
Is it a strange – I mean, I feel like it's such a strange time to – we've only been married since August, but eventually, you know, kids are around the corner. But it just feels like such a weird time to be raising kids. There's not a lot of, I feel like, positive imagery in the world. And there's a lot of craziness and it's just the devices and how do you make them connect?
Yeah. I mean, we're just on the verge of like, they don't have phones yet, but I'm afraid that, I'll never speak to them again after that all opens up. So it's a little scary, especially, you know, for my generation that didn't have that growing up. It's how do you keep them in the real world? And then it is weird. I'm sure for every generation, it's probably weird, but it seems especially sci-fi.
I think it's especially weird now because, I mean, I guess when I was a kid, you know, the video game revolution was just starting, but now, I mean, there's just this all the time and it's so compelling. If you're a parent and you're busy, you're like, just keep them occupied.
Oh, yeah.
But then they're just not connecting with anything.
No, and then the idea of YouTube stars is really confusing to me. that they think it's great to be famous for no reason. I it's hard for me because,
Are your kids artistic in any way? Are you fostering art?
Oh, but I think all kids are. They like to draw and tell stories. But I think hopefully all kids do. And then you can hold on to that if you can.
But there's something... I feel like there's something particularly potent in the Coppola genes. I love your cousin, by the way. I know Jason. Yes.
He's the best.
He's just the sweetest, most wonderful guy.
Oh, he is.
But there's something in your family's genes of like, these are all very artistic, talented people.
I know. I guess, it's crazy that everyone is so – there's so many creative people in my family. So it's – I guess there's a gene somewhere.
But it's not even just – I mean, it seems like it's a specific type of creativity. It's a type of creativity. It's like, I'm going to go just forge this path of, I'm going to do, you know, these are things that I enjoy doing and I'm going to forge this path. And it doesn't really feel like anyone, I don't know, follows any particular rules that are put forth by the entertainment industry.
Oh yeah. I never really thought about it, but I guess there's been, you know, examples. My dad set an example of just going out and doing his thing. So maybe by seeing that we'd learn something from him
being
a kind of outsider.
But you went to art school, right?
I did. I went to Cal Arts for a little bit and then Art Center, which I didn't finish school, but I did my time. I wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a painter.
And then do you still paint?
No, I tried to recently and it was discouraged. So I'd like to try again. But
that's really interesting to hear you say that, because for me, when I watch one of your movies, it always feels like this wide, beautiful portrait.
Oh, cool.
Like not even just visually, but story-wise too, it just sort of feels like a portrait.
Oh, interesting.
And I feel like at the end, you're sort of left with interpreting what you think it meant to you when you were looking at it.
Oh, good. Because I want to have that impression and not, I don't think like, here's a message I want to tell the audience. I want them to experience it and then take away what they do, whatever it is personal to them. So that's nice. I never thought about maybe there's the connection from my wanting to be a painter.
Do you feel like the audience is always right if they go, oh, the movie's about this, and they go and someone else goes, no, it's actually about this? Do you feel like it's very personal and that they're all, everyone's right?
Yeah, that's the best, when people talk about it and have different ideas and yeah, that's the most you could hope for.
Yeah. Did you always, was directing something you always wanted to do, or you just fell into it after art school?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I never thought about it. I mean, I spent my whole life on my dad's sets and was watching him work. And he always talked to my brother and I about writing and directing as if, you know, he was, you know, teaching all the time. So, but it just never occurred to me, or maybe I was just resisting going into the family business. And yeah, so then I spent my 20s trying different things, and it was hard to figure out. I couldn't like find that one thing that was satisfying all my different interests until I made a short film, just, you know, kind of for fun. And then I thought, oh, this is incorporating all the things I love with music and photography and the things I couldn't pick just one.
Sure.
I found it annoying that I had to pick one thing. And then I read The Virgin Suicides, and I heard they were making a movie of it. And I thought, I hope they don't mess it up, because I love that book. And so I decided to, just as an experiment, to try to adapt that on my own, and see like how you'd write a screenplay from a book. And then I got so into it that I wrote the script, and I thought, now I felt really attached to it. And so I tracked down the producers and I said, would you please look at my script? And somehow they let me direct the movie. And I know. And I really wasn't planning on being a director. It was really that book that made me, just out of wanting to protect that book. And I was so clear about how it had to be made as a movie that I had some kind of drive to make it.
And was there any part of you that was like, shit, if I do this, then there's all, you know, people are going to, they're going to compare and it's weird, or just don't worry about that?
I just tried not to think about it. I was just so focused on, I wanted to tell that story, and I had to get that. You know, when you get an idea of something and it nags at you, and I just had to listen to that. But I tried not to be too self-conscious and I just thought I had to do it.
I mean, it worked out fine. I think that hurdle was overcome very, very, very quickly.
No, but it's always there was always, you know, there's always a part of that. But I felt, you know, compelled to make my work.
Yeah. And so when you were finished with that, because I think it was about maybe 4 years, was Lost in Translation 03?
I think it was around then. I made Virgin Suicides in 99. And so, yeah, it was a couple of years later. It usually takes me a couple of years in between films, because I write the script. I have to think about what I'm interested in and then write a script. And then by the time you get the financing together, and with Lost in Translation, I spent a year trying to track down Bill Murray. So that had to be factored in.
I mean, you're lucky it was only a year, because I hear that guy is like,
he is mysterious.
He is mysterious. he may just appear. Like if you're having a bar mitzvah, he might just appear at it. You don't know when Bill Murray is going
to
appear.
Yeah, it's always it's never boring. It's always it's always exciting to hear about a Bill Murray spotting, I think.
St. Vincent, I think the guy who directed St. Vincent. Yeah. And he's just left messages on this infamous voicemail that Bill Murray has. And he would just nag him and never heard back. And then one day his phone just rang and he was like, hey, I'm landing in LA and, you know, can you pick me up? Let's talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. My story is not dissimilar. I left messages on the 800 number for ages. And luckily my friend Mitch Glazer, who's a writer who works with him, I showed him some of what I was writing for Lost in Translation. He thought it was interesting that I saw him that way, and he was really helpful and, you know, told Bill that he should meet me. And one day he just called me out of the blue, Mitch, and said, I'm here with Bill. He says, come by. They were at a restaurant in New York, and I'll never forget going to see him, and he was wearing a seersucker suit.
Of course he was. Of course he was. And then do you guys immediately hit it off?
Yeah, he was really nice to me, and I was, you know, smitten. It's Bill Murray, and then but he still never committed to doing the movie. And it really wasn't until I went to Japan, like, that I even it was like, is he going to show up and do this? And I think he said, I'm inclined to do it, and then that was it. And then he showed up.
Oh wow!
So it was scary the moments before he showed up.
So what have you learned about working with actors? Like, how do you know, especially with someone like Bill Murray, who I'm sure is a very nice guy, but probably has a very specific way of, I mean, every actor I'm sure has a specific way of doing things. Some people probably want more direction. Some people probably want to just do their own thing. So how do you do have to, I imagine, be in the personality management business as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think so much of it is just casting. You know, that casting the right person, they're going to bring whatever you see in them connects to the character. So I think that's the biggest part, is the casting. And then just being clear what the, you know, what the story is and what your kind of what the tone is, and encouraging the side that you are looking for, and kind of changing the subject for a direction that isn't so much what you're doing, I guess. But yeah, I just feel like they bring so much to it, and then it's fun to work together to, and then a lot of it comes together in the editing room too.
Gotcha. Where you go. I mean, do you feel like there are certain things that if you're not getting out of an actor, like, do you have tricks where you're like, oh, maybe, you know, are there certain little fun director things that you can do to trick people into getting what you want out of them?
I feel like I've always had a good bunch, pretty much. Like, they haven't had too much trouble. I'm trying to think. I always ask my dad about that, because he comes from theater, and so he does a lot of, like, rehearsals and theater games. And I remember saying, like, what do you do when someone's not, if they're not being natural or acting? And he has different little tricks, which I have to remember in his notes. But I remember him saying that if someone if you don't like what they're doing, just ask them to just talk about their morning and try to get them to be themselves and forget about acting. So there's things like that. But I haven't had, I mean, I've worked with such great actors, and they've understood what I was looking for, I guess.
Well, I mean, I imagine, I guess in that sense, you're probably pretty clear up top.
Yeah.
I mean, are you very methodical about how everything is mapped out? Do you know, like, do you have, like, the, okay, everything's storyboarded, this is exactly what I'm going to, you don't?
Oh, no, not at all. I feel like I could never storyboard a movie. I mean, I think it's interesting people that do, but I don't know until I'm on the set with the actors, you know, where the camera's going to go, until you see them blocking it. Because, you know, the actors have opinions about what feels right to them. And so I try to be flexible and figure it out as we go. It's more intuitive.
Gotcha. And then do you feel like you learn a new thing each time you get through and go, wow, I thought I knew everything, but now I know this.
No, I always feel like when I start a movie that it's a challenge, and it's like doing it for the first time, and then there's always things that I learn. I can't think if I know specifically what it is, but I always feel like I'm learning something. And with this movie, The Beguiled, I like doing a movie in a genre I've never done before. So I felt like, oh, that's interesting to learn, like, how to do a movie in a genre that's still connected to how I do things and in my style.
Yeah. And do you feel, and so you actually do feel like you, when you, if you look at all your, because when I look at your movies, I go, those are all from the same, I can tell they're from the same person, even though they don't all don't look the same.
Oh, thank you.
So is that just a natural function of just you doing it? Or do you feel like there's a conscious decision of like, oh, I feel like I need to have it be this way?
No, I think it just comes from, I put myself and my personality into it. So I just pick the things that I'm into. And so I guess that comes across. And I feel like that with movies that I, or filmmakers that I like, you can see I love when you can see the person who made it and know that's a so-and-so movie, instead of just something that anyone could make, that it comes from their point of view. So I think that, I hope that comes across.
Sure.
And so in any, even though the movies are different, that they all come from my point of view, I guess. Or
why? Well, mm-hmm. I hope this is not a stupid question.
No,
I apologize. This is a dumb question. And going back to what we said earlier, you might go, sure, if you think that, then maybe that's what it is. Do you feel like there is a recurring theme of isolation with your characters? Mm-hmm. Even, I mean, like, you know, Lost in Translation, he seems emotionally isolated, and he's also isolated in Japan. In The Beguiled, they're isolated. In this Southern, the Virgin Suicides, this family seems kind of isolated at the same time. Like, is there a thread?
No, you're right, there is, but I don't know why. I don't set out to be like, I want to do stories about isolation. But I love that about this story in The Beguiled. They're so, these women so cut off, and the women at wartime cut off from the rest of the world, and they're like ghosts. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know why I am interested in stories about that. I guess, I don't know. I think when I'm writing, I'm in a more introverted mood because you're alone writing, sure. And you have to face yourself or whatever. So it's not my, other side that's more, connected with things. So maybe that has something to do with it, but I don't know. And I like stories about identity and people finding that. And so that's a more introspective thing, I guess, but I don't feel isolated as a person.
Right. Oh, that's cool. But, that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, these women are basically stuck. I don't want to give too much away so people don't feel like anything's spoiled, but essentially they're isolated during this Civil War. And so I think of a lot of questions like, how do they all get there together? Are they all related or not related or friends or some of the kids are like,
it's a Southern girls school. So the girls were sent there to go to school, and then the war broke out and they can't go home. They're stuck there. And I love it. It's during that time of the South and the Civil War where they were like raised to be hostesses and have parties and be lovely for gentlemen. And it's all kind of about that. And then all of a sudden the party's over, there's no men around and they're kind of stuck.
To the extent where they'll say things in the movie like, oh, the next soldiers aren't going to be by for months, probably. So they're literally just in a plantation.
Yeah. And the slaves left and they have to learn how to survive on their own. And they weren't raised to do that. So they're really totally cut off from the world. And how I imagine it was like for these women during the war. And I think it's interesting to think about, the women left behind during the wartime.
Right. Because then it raises a bunch of other questions like, well, where do they go? What happens? Where do they go from?
At the end of the story.
Yeah, I'm sure there's not going to be like a Beguiled too. <Two. unless> you...
Yeah, I like that you just felt like, that they're not going anywhere, I think.
They're not going anywhere for a while. Is it smack dab in the middle of the Civil War? Or is it kind of
a couple years, a couple years into it.
So there's still a lot of runway between them and the end of the war.
Yeah, but not that, it wasn't that long. Yeah, right. So.
What is your writing process?
I don't know what happens to them after the war. That's a good question.
Well, I guess it doesn't really matter. I guess it's sort of left. To, I mean, when people see the end of the movie.
It's fun to think about what happens to them. Yeah.
But especially the last shot, which I won't give away. Yeah. But it does. That's also like a really beautiful portrait where you're just looking at that. If you just even just saw that as a painting, I think you go, what the fuck happened? What's going to happen with these people?
I like it. I mean, it reminded me a little bit of a portrait, the way they're waiting in the gate. But yes. I won't say too much.
No. Because people definitely, there is a twist. And people, we don't want to give that away. Because people get angrier at spoilers now than almost anything else on our planet.
Well, I think it's fun to see it without knowing too much. Yeah. Because then it's more of a surprise.
So what's your writing? What is your writing process when you say are you like a 9-to-5er or is it just I just write until I can't write anymore?
Oh yeah. I'm kind of winging it. I used to, before having kids, I would stay up all night and write at night, which was my favorite. And now I've had to learn I have to wake up in the morning with a little kid, with kids. So I can't do that anymore. So I just kind of fit it in whenever I can. And I have a little office and during the day I'll try to be disciplined, but it's not too structured.
Do you allow your brain to wander and get distracted, or do you have tricks for forcing yourself to just squeeze it out when you...
No, it's hard. I think it's, you have to build in time for procrastinating and putter time, just where you're not doing anything, because that's when you get ideas. So it's hard, like when you have more of a structured life and you have a babysitter for 2 hours and you have to, you can't just sit and like flip through books or whatever. Yeah, I find it hard. It's hard to be disciplined about writing, but I don't know, somehow I got through it.
Yeah, I mean, but you must have times where you just feel like, okay, I just started and I can't, my brain is just frozen.
Yeah. I don't know. I should know what my tricks are. I guess it's good just to go do something else. But and I remember talking to my friend Tamara Jenkins, who's also a director and a writer, because we were both writing at the same time. And she got a program called Freedom so that it cuts off your internet on your computer so you can write.
Oh.
So that you don't get distracted with going online and emails and stuff. So that was good to know about, because there's so many distractions.
It's just all distractions.
I know.
Now. And you know, it's funny because I think that is... I think that's what people want. They want to be distracted because no one really wants to deal with stuff. It's not fun to deal with stuff. So we're just all distractions.
I know, but I'm worried about with like, everyone on their phone all the time. Like when I was telling my kids, like, you need time to space out. Like, when do you just space out? Because that's when you get ideas and that's when you think about things. And I'm worried that our culture doesn't have enough just spacing out, quiet time.
I 100% agree, because it's too enticing to just have something distract you and engage you all the time.
And even in line to get a coffee, like everyone's on there.
Everyone's on their phone. Like, you're in an elevator. You're in an elevator for what? 32 seconds? And you still like your phone's out and you're still scrolling around.
I know. I'm just going to try to cut the cord a little.
Are you super internet-y? Are you a social media at all? Do you
No, not at all.
So smart.
Open that can of worms.
Are you worried that you would get sucked into it, or just that the toxicity of it would sort of bleed into your psyche?
Yeah, it just seems like such a big commitment, and I just don't even want to go there too much.
Are you able to, you know, with do you read reviews, or are you able to, or do you take criticism well, or do you just
no? No, who does? No, I try not to. It's because you can read 100 or hear 100 good things, and then you hear one unkind thing, and that's the only thing you stage in your mind. So I try not to look at it too much.
Yeah. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because people are by nature just insecure that they're always doing the wrong thing?
I don't know. It's from the way our brain works, but I need to ask an expert. I don't know.
I feel like maybe it has something to do with, you know, throughout evolution, you know, we are evolved to need to like be in a tribe. Then the second it feels like the tribe is not accepting you, you're like, my genes are going to die. Like, I always feel like it always
must
come.
Yeah, it must have some survival.
I always feel like my genes are going to die is ultimately the big thing that I was afraid of.
Yeah, it's probably just built into us. Yeah.
Do you ever feel like doing is there like a movie that like a big scope type of a, you know, I don't want to say like superhero movie, but like an action movie or a horror movie or any kind of crazy other genre that you would want to try? Mm-hmm.
There isn't one like I'm always wondering about. So, but I never say never. I'm open. But no, I haven't thought about like one that I'd love to tackle.
You know, there's not like a horror movie inside you somewhere just waiting to sneak out.
No, I'm kind of curious about sci-fi, but I don't have any ideas in that genre.
It's really easy. Just think of whatever movie you're going to think of and just be like, in space.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. Beguiled in space. They're on an asteroid.
That's so funny. I don't know if I would know how to do that.
You don't know. What do you watch when you're at home? Is it movies, television?
I'd like when you get like to get into a TV show, but I haven't lately. What have I watched? I don't know. I watch movies and I watched, I don't know, that was a while ago, like the OJ documentary series. I'm behind on things, but
is it kids mostly that kind of eat up the time that you would be sitting around vegging out in front of a television?
I don't know. I've just been so busy finishing this movie and then being with my kids, and I don't know what I'm what I've been doing, but it seems busy. Or like trying to catch up on emails by the end of my real life day. But I love it's fun to get sucked into a show or, watch movies.
Yeah. Is the business...
Do you have any recommendations?
Yeah,
one that
tons.
You're watching now?
Well, let's see. What are we watching now that's really good? Well, we watch a lot of horror, and we watch a lot of true crime.
See, I don't want to get stressed out at bed when I'm going to sleep. I want escapism.
Okay. Yeah. Baskets is great.
Oh, I heard that. Okay. I love him, so I need to watch that.
Zach Galifianakis' show. It's such a beautiful show. It's beautifully shot. It's incredibly acted. Louis Anderson plays his mom, and he is stunning on the show. I mean, everyone is so good on the show.
Oh, I have to see it.
Yeah. And on paper, the premise is... is really hokey. I mean, like, it's, he's a clown and he wants to be taken seriously as a clown. He went to clown school in France and he's terrible. And there's just this like Buster Keaton layer of sadness to it, but it's so funny and so real somehow.
Oh yeah, I heard it was great, and I really love him, so I have to see it.
Yeah, I recommend I recommend that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope you like it. Have you ever thought about television or like a, you know, I'm going to do a 6-8 episode mini arc?
I like the idea of, I still call them mini series, but yes, the idea of a limited series. But I like the idea because as a kid, like 80s glamorous mini series was very glamorous. Yeah, I love that. So I'd love to do something really glamorous for that. But I know I haven't thought of one, but it's definitely, I think it's exciting now that you can have an idea that can be 5 hours long or it can be 20 minutes long, that there's an outlet for that, which really wasn't when I started making films.
Yeah. And well, I think the interesting part of that, though, is some of the stuff that's a limited run, you watch and you go, this could have just been a movie. This didn't need to be like
really?
8 episodes long. Like, there's sometimes you'll get like...
They're not suited.
Well, you just get to like episode 3, 4, 5 and you're like, they're really trying
stretching
to...
Stretching it.
They're really trying to stretch this out.
Oh, that's true.
By the time you get into the edit bay, do you ever... Are you always pretty confident, like, I've got enough of what I needed? Or are you ever stressed, like, oh, we're going to get there and then this shot's not going to be there?
Yeah, well, luckily my editor is in touch. She's cutting while we're filming, so she can tell us if we're missing something. So she always tells us, okay, like, we got enough for that. So I'm not as worried that we're missing a shot. But you're always – it's always a relief that it cuts together. It's always like, oh, wow, it works. So it's always a pleasant surprise when it comes together.
But I guess part of that, too, is just trusting that you know what you're doing at this point.
Yeah, and then having my editor – checking it every day and telling us. Yeah. And I'm working with a team that's really pro. My cinematographer, Philippe Lassort, who's great, you know, helped a lot to make sure we had all the coverage we needed.
Yeah. Do you ever give talks or anything? Do you ever, like, just for to inspire young people, particularly young women who might not think, oh, a film is, I could direct a movie.
Oh, yeah. I don't see myself as a good public speaker, but I'm happy to do question and answers and answer questions. And I went to NYU and talked to a class, and we had 3 young women film students on set who are watching. And so I'm happy to try to be helpful to any young filmmakers.
Does it feel like the business is getting any better about encouraging female artists?
You know, it hasn't changed a lot since when I started in 99, which is discouraging, but it just feels like it's in the air. A lot of people are talking about it right now. It's exciting that Wonder Woman was such a big hit.
Right.
And I think it's starting to be known that there is a audience for, you know, female driven subject matter.
Yeah.
So that's encouraging.
Yeah. But I also, I mean, I kind of have a little bit of like bro movie fatigue, where it's like, okay, these two dudes are just gonna beat the shit out of each other and knock all the buildings down in the process.
Oh yeah,
there's a little fatigue about that.
I'm sure. Yeah, there's so many of those. Yeah, the whole superhero thing has been milked, drawn out, I guess. But it's not really my thing, so I know people enjoy that too.
I feel like there's. I feel like you could do a really cool superhero movie, because you would have your point of view on it would be different.
So like meandering existential superhero.
Yes, exactly. I mean, honestly, think about, look, we've already seen, like, you know, so much, a lot of superhero movies are so much about what they can do physically. But imagine if, you know, let's just say all of a sudden you had some sort of crazy, that would fuck with your head. Like, you would have a lot of psychological issues to process. There would be a lot of stuff to deal
with.
That's
so funny.
I think we're getting to the point where we've seen so many superhero movies, but really kind of exploring the psychology.
You want the Sopranos. You want the Sopranos version.
Yes. That's a great idea. Yeah, that's a really great idea. I feel like there could be something.
Zach Galifianakis can be the...
Zach would be in it.
Yeah, he can be the superhero who's doubting his newfound powers.
I mean, you know, we're riffing and it's silly, but at the same time, I'm telling you, I really think there's something really cool there. If you directed it and Zach was in it, I would see the shit out of that movie.
Okay. Because
because at least it's not, you know, I think there's something really interesting about coming into a genre that has such an expected path and then being able to spin it and go, well, here's a completely alternative point of view.
Yeah, no, I think it's fun, the idea of playing with genre. But...
yeah. Is there, I mean, when you look at everything you've done, is there a specific genre that you feel like, oh, this is more what I'm suited to?
No, I just sort of do my thing, but it was fun on this movie to get into like a Southern Gothic and really embrace the genre aspect and have girls in nightgowns with candelabras and kind of be part of that history or something. And there was a fun challenge in that.
And that, I imagine that also probably affects how you're setting the scene when there's no electricity and everything has to be, you know.
Yeah, yeah. We try to make it look authentic, but it was fun to have lots of candelabras and it added to the whole Gothic vibe of it, and the point, the spikes on the gate, and just the angles, like in the last section of the movie, the angles get more heightened of the camera, and you know, it's kind of, and a little bit of gore for me, had some gore.
Oh yeah, yes, there's definitely a little bit,
yeah,
just a little bit, just enough.
Yes,
just enough
for me. It was a lot, but for a normal movie, yes, it's just a hint.
Were you not so gore is not your you?
Yeah, no, it's not my thing. But it was funny because I would have meetings with the special effects makeup guy, and he was like, "How big do you want the wound?" And was really into it. And I was like, "You know, whatever you think, you know." So it was funny.
Well, yeah, because I imagine, especially at that time, any wound is a potentially life-threatening scenario.
Yeah, it's a different. Back then, it was more grave.
And it's not like they can pour Bactine on it, so they're basically everything just looks kind of disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to embrace that, because I think if we were able to travel back in time, I think the biggest thing we would have to deal with is not immediately vomiting from the smells of another era.
Yeah.
Because it's just, everything's just, you know.
Yeah, it definitely was. That must have been very different.
It's a smelly, it was a smelly time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a smelly time. So much commercialism basically taught us that we have to, you know, be presentable and use deodorant and use soap and use it. But for most of human history, I feel like.
Yeah, that wasn't the case. So one of the good things of living in the modern age, I guess.
Is there another era particularly that you are drawn to?
No, I can't think of. I mean, I enjoyed working on Marie Antoinette because it was fun to get into 18th century and Versailles. And that was probably a really smelly place, speaking of that. But no, I haven't thought of a specific era that I would love to get into.
But Marie Antoinette, too. Marie Antoinette was also like another so beautiful and colorful, and but kind of had like this modern feel to it.
That one I was being more pop with because they were teenagers and I wanted it to have a pop feeling. It reminded me of like New Romantic videos when I was a kid. They were always into that period. Yeah. So I was kind of having fun with all of that.
But also the idea that in a way, it almost felt like she was kind of a prisoner.
In her gilded cage.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that has that too. I like that about the story, that kind of that she was thrown into a role that she wasn't really, she didn't choose.
Yeah.
And how you find your way within where you've ended up.
So when you're directing that, you're writing that, when you're adapting that, is that more based on the book, or are you looking at history as well? It's like, I'd probably be able
to... That I was adapting it from Antonia Fraser wrote a biography about her. Yeah. It was more kind of, not from her point of view, kind of her side of the story, because most histories, she's a villain. So that was interesting to kind of just follow her take on it. So I used that. I think I probably could have done more research, but it was so overwhelming to learn all the history. That, like, the parts about the political side was less interesting about, you know, the, I don't know, we call those Star Wars scenes when they had like all the ministers sitting on the table and like, we need to leave. And I was just like, oh, so out of my element. But we had to have a little of that in it. But I preferred the stuff that was more about her, you know, emotions. And
yeah. Did you learn a lot about, did you learn more about directing from hanging around the set when you were a kid or from acting?
Definitely from being around my dad's sets. I mean, it helped to be a little bit in front of the camera, just to know how vulnerable that is. And so I'm sensitive with my actors, but I learned so much from being on my dad's set all the time.
Yeah.
And it was always fun and exciting to go to the set and the people that were around him, you know, all the people he worked with. And
I always like to ask directors what do you think the job of a director is? Like, when you go to work, what is it that you think you're doing? How do you define it?
Oh, that's funny. I never. Good question.
Well, everyone has a different. Everyone has a slightly.
What
different
am I doing?
Take on it.
I mean, you have this idea in your head of this story you want to make, and then you just get all your team together and ask them to help you make it.
And that's it.
You're just telling a story, or I definitely have an idea of what the movie looks like in my head, and then it's. I heard Fellini one time say that it's like trying to remember a dream, and I thought that's the most. The closest thing I can relate to it, you know, you just have this idea in your head, and then you have to communicate it to the team helping you with the visual side of it, and the actors and everyone to interpret that, and then kind of keep guiding it to this idea you have in your head.
Yeah, because if you're painting, you just have a brush and it's you, and that's it, and it's a canvas. But you really are managing a lot of people that cover a lot of disciplines.
Yeah, so you have to be clear to them about how you want each element to be and what you're doing.
Yeah. Do you think does the story inform the characters, or do you think the characters inform the story? Like where do you kind of lean if?
Oh, I guess more from the characters. Like I'm interested in stories that are driven by the characters, but yeah. I guess they both affect each other. And this was more, for me, much more plot driven, which I've never done anything that was so, thinking about tension and suspense and that the plot was really unfolding, which was an experiment for me.
Yeah. I mean, if you're shooting this in 26 days, you said, are you just doing like two takes of everything and be like, we got to move on?
I know. Not that bad. We had a little more time, but it was you like one big scene, then you rush right into the next one and you can't even, it's kind of good because you can't think too much about it. You just have to keep going.
Yeah. I think that's...
You can't doubt yourself.
You
don't have time for that.
I think that's a good thing. You can doubt yourself after. You're just like, you defer it. Mm-hmm. Like, I'll just defer this. Mm-hmm. Have you done a lot of... I really think that there would be... I think there's also a great thing for you with... It's not that I'm telling you what you need to do with your career, but I think it'd be really great if you were able to do more Q&A type stuff for more just...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, just because I think people, especially now because people can, make anything so inexpensively.
Oh, yeah.
And even just in the short time since you started... Things were very different in the 90s in terms of like, you really do have to get film. You got to get...
Yeah, no, it's cool that I still love shooting on film. This was shot on film. But I think when people ask me like, what's your advice? It's like anyone can make a movie and just to try things out. It's great that it's accessible and that you can just try things out and it's not anyone can do it.
Yeah. How much of it to you is science and how much of it is it art and gut? Where you're like, every so often this thing has to happen, or just, I'll feel it.
Yeah, it is more intuitive, I think, to me. But then there's things I know just from, learning about like the act structure and things from my dad was a writer first before directing. So I think I learned about writing from him talking about writing. And so it's a combination, I think, of having some history and knowledge of that, and then being intuitive of what feels right.
Right. Do you?
Is that too vague?
No, not at all. Actually, yeah. I mean, it is. I think you probably because the recurring theme that seems to come up is just like flexibility.
Yeah.
Where it doesn't matter how rigid you are going into something, going, this definitely has to,
Yeah, because you can't control it. Things happen. You lose your location. Like you have to be flexible and just come up with, reacting to the situation and how that can be close to the path that you're trying to make.
Yeah. Are you a pretty patient person in general?
I don't know. Not I can be, but then I'm not when I'm excited about something, then I'm not patient.
But it doesn't... You don't seem particularly aggressive. Like,
No, I'm not.
So your impatience is just more of like an excitement.
Yeah.
Like, let's do this. Let's make this.
Yeah.
And you still feel that way when you go on a set? You still feel that?
Yeah. This one, I really wanted to make this movie. And it's always a challenge to get it all together. And I just was so determined that I wanted to make this movie. And I think you have to have that because you hear a lot of no's and then you just have to find another way around it. So it helps to be kind of stubborn.
Sure. Mm. Yeah. Or persevere. Because you also, I know you work in fashion. I mean, you have worked in fashion too. But I imagine that's a completely separate.
Yeah. I mean, that's so, I like to do kind of side projects and smaller things because movies are so involved and it takes years. And so it's nice in between just to do kind of smaller things. to dabble creatively.
Yeah. Do you ever just kind of run out and go, you know, I'm just going to go shoot a short film this weekend. I don't really know what it's going to be. I'm just going to go just to scratch that itch.
No, I wish. No, no. But my 10-year-old daughter's really into horror and gore, so I thought we could make a horror film this summer. So I got to get that together.
That'd be really fun. I should give you I'll get you a list of some really good horror movies.
Oh, yeah. I would love to know.
Like good arty horror movies.
Yeah. Your favorites.
Yeah. There's one out now that she might like because it centers around a little girl. It's called The Girl with All the Gifts.
Oh,
Glenn
cool.
Close is in it.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
It's this really cool. I think it might be British because everyone else in the movie is British but her.
Oh, okay.
But it's kind of a zombie apocalypse story, but it all kind of centers around this one little girl.
Oh, cool.
It's really cool.
Is it scary?
Yeah.
But not too scary.
No, well, I mean,
she'll love it.
Zombie, I mean, like any good zombie movie is gory.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is a lot of like blood and flesh tearing. But if she's,
she'll love that.
So if she's yeah. cool with that. Yeah. She'll probably like it. I mean, you know, it. Do you think you will encourage your kids if they want to go in entertainment? Do you think it'd be like, sure, do it. Why not? Or are you going
to
be like,
I don't know. I can't. I want them to do what they want to do. But I'm not like guiding them and trying to push them in that direction.
Right. But it doesn't sound like your dad really pushed you in any particular direction.
No, but he always just talked to us about as if we're just going to do that. You know, like he was always talking about like, well, when you're writing the script, you make sure, you know, so he, I think it's just, he was so always so passionate about his work and he always talked about it in such a excited way that you can't help kind of being around that and get into it.
Yeah. Kind of seems like with kids though, and this is just my guess because I don't have them, but if you tell a kid like, do this, they're going to be like, no. But if you just sort of leave some clues around and they feel like they're sort of discovering it for themselves, then maybe that's the way in.
Yeah, I was like, when we were growing up, he was always watching interesting movies and we were exposed to, you know, great movies. And I think like kids, they don't want to watch, you know, it can't be like, here, we're going to watch this. It was better that he just had it on and we were there and we saw them, you know, as opposed to whenever I try to show them something like, we don't want to watch an old movie, you know? So, but I think it's helpful to be, exposed to some culture.
Well, especially the pacing of old movies.
Yeah.
I don't know how a kid would sit through.
Yeah.
Even anything from like the 70s or the 80s.
I know.
Where it's just like, they really take their time.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's funny because we were watching Trading Places the other day, which I love, and it was really fun to watch with them. But then, like, Jamie Lee Curtis would just take her top off for no reason. And they were like, why is she taking her top off? And I was like, well, it was in the 80s, probably a guy directed it.
It was John Landis.
Yeah, it was so, yeah. I love that movie, but it was just funny to revisit with them.
I think some of that, too, was honestly, I think some of that was probably just like, well, you know, we got to put boobs in it for international. Like,
no, I think the international sales was based on like how many topless shots. That was like a thing then, I think. But I love that movie. Dan Aykroyd with the salmon and the beard.
And the Christmas scene at the end. Yeah. But you're right. There is literally no reason for Jamie Lee Curtis to have her boobs out of there. There's like, it doesn't serve.
Yeah, there were two scenes right in a row that had nothing to do with it. Yeah, no plot.
Oh, yeah. One of them's Eddie Murphy has a bunch of people over to his house, when he takes over the house. And there's just a woman in his bed.
Oh,
and he's
like,
put your clothes on and get out of here.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that one.
But it's just, there's just no. Yeah.
Yeah. That one sort of fits in a little bit because they're being decadent. But,
right.
But when she brings him home to the apartment and she's like just changing in the bathroom while he's getting settled in.
It is really the era of 80, the 80s are really could be defined with the words gratuitous boobs.
Yeah. I just forgot about that. Like we all grew up with that. I didn't even notice at the time.
Well, that was those R-rated comedies in the 80s were.
Oh,
like,
right. The whole Porky's.
Yeah. Porky's or I get Fast Times was probably R-rated, wasn't it?
I just remember that the Phoebe Cates moment that everyone said the VHS copies were all messed up because everyone rewound that. The boys rewound that scene.
Oh, that's the one where Judge Reinhold is just cranking it and thinking about Phoebe Cates.
Yeah, yeah. I love that movie, though. It's such a classic.
How do you define that era? Like, what do you think when you think back of, you know, 80s movies? Like, what do you think that was? What do you think it was that they were, you know?
I haven't sat back and asked myself that question. What were they thinking?
Well, I mean, just like, you know, like defining the sort of like the tone of an era or the vibe of an era.
Oh, yeah. I feel like it was sort of had an innocence to it or I don't know. I don't know. I love those John Hughes movies and all those movies we're talking about. They had a kind of optimism or something.
Yeah. Do you feel particularly optimistic? Are you an optimistic person?
I wouldn't say that I am, but I try not to be negative. But I kind of stay in a little bubble and not try not to be too aware of the awful things that are going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love to figure out how to climb into that bubble.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Yeah, once you're not in that, I'm not sure how you...
It's the Matrix, right? Yeah, once you take the pill, yeah. It's like, well, you're yeah. sorry, you can't go back.
Yeah,
this is it. You know
you
what it is.
You can cut off some. I think.
What is it? You know, when you have free time, what do you do with it?
I don't remember. No, I've just been working on this. I think I don't know, seeing friends and going. I love to see movies in the theater. And New York has, you know, old movies, which are fun to see. And, I don't know. I have lots of interests, but I'm into taking photos, but I haven't done anything outside of this movie in so long that I don't
remember. It's hard to remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think New York would be a much better place to live to go to movie theaters. Cause you know, LA driving, traffic and parking are always the biggest consideration. Oh. Like, oh, we could go there, but then I know.
It's hard when you have a nice setup at home. But then I think when you see a movie with an audience, I think it's so, I don't know, it's so enjoyable to, it's such a different experience.
Can you watch your movies with an audience?
Like this one, The Beguiled, I've seen recently, and it's really fun to watch it with the audience because they laugh and people are freaked out. And it's such a different experience. I'm used to seeing it, you know, just me and the editor but without a reaction. So, yeah, I really enjoy it.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, and there's like that kind of communal thing that happens that you forget when you're home streaming things.
And I imagine you're surprised by things that people react to. Like, oh, I didn't realize that would be a thing that people would.
Well, there's things that we thought were really funny, so it was so enjoyable when you hear people laughing and catching those moments that you weren't sure if they were, you know, how noticeable they are. So it's fun.
Yeah. I feel like we're probably getting close to your
okay.
time because it's just after 5.
I'm going to see the at the New Beverly tonight. Quentin Tarantino. We're doing a double feature of the Don Siegel Beguiled, my movie, with a Q&A.
Oh, that's fantastic!
So,
is he doing Q&A and you're doing Q&A?
He's asking me questions.
Oh, he's asking you questions.
Yeah, we're talking about it. So,
I mean, I would imagine you guys are friends at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it'll be fun to talk to him because he's so enthusiastic.
Yeah, I mean, and it's really cool that the thing that he did with the New Beverly is such a great.
I know. I haven't been there in years, so I'm excited to go.
I mean, every time I drive by, it's on the way to one of the places that I work. And I was like, shit, that double feature looks really good.
Right, I know. You got to make more time for double features.
It'll be like, you know, Stripes and Ghostbuster. You know, it's just like he's such a. He's so passionate about.
I know. It's so cool that he's doing that. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, June 23rd is the movie. Do you have any last bits of, I don't know. I always like to find out from people, like, what's like a guiding principle or what's a piece of wisdom that you have that you kind of keep in your head, a guiding principle of sorts?
Oh, that's a good question. What is my, I don't know. I try to, I mean, I try to only work on things that I really love and don't do something for money.
Right.
That's important. Like, you have to really, I think, you know, something that you would just do if no one was paying, just that you'd have to do as far as creatively.
Are you okay taking money? I mean, like, in the sense that if someone was like, here's a shit ton of money to do this thing, do you feel like, oh, even if it's something that I'm passionate about, does that get in the way?
No, I mean, I've never had that experience. But if it was something that I was passionate about, then I'm all for it. But I just mean, to make sure you're doing the things you really love.
Yeah. Excellent.
And, yeah.
Well, I'm so glad. I hope you
had a nice... And I look to, like, Muhammad Ali as someone that's dignified and graceful under pressure.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah, I think about him.
You think about Muhammad Ali often.
I do. I mean, he's like one of my role models for when things are, you know, when you're struggling with something, like his whole rope-a-dope.
Did you ever get to meet him?
No, I didn't. But I remember someone telling me when I was going to show my first movie in Cannes, Virgin Suicides, and I was nervous, and he said that Muhammad Ali, when he goes into the ring, he would think, did I train hard enough? Did I do everything I could to prepare? And that helped me to think like, yeah, okay, I did everything I could and, you know, you see what happens.
Well, that's an excellent piece.
Okay.
That is a great landing point.
Oh, good.
But it was a really pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the movie. And, you know, I'm a fan of your work and I'm a fan of your family and I love Jason. And I'm going to shoot him an email afterwards.
He's the
sweetest guy. He told me a story. And he didn't tell it on the podcast, but it was after a podcast about Colin Farrell, who was in The Beguiled.
Oh, yeah. He knew him. I don't know that about meeting his little daughter or
no. Jason, this is just what a sweet guy he is. He goes, I think it was maybe a Beatles book or something. He ordered a book.
Oh, yeah. What was that story? I can't remember that, but yeah, tell me.
He ordered a book. And he had been waiting weeks, you know, for forever to get this book. And he finally got this book and he met Colin Farrell and he was so charmed and it's like at a loss for words. And Colin Farrell goes, oh, that book, I know, I've been dying to read that. And Jason just goes, here, I got this for you and just gave it to him.
Yes, I remember that.
And I go, did you get to read the book? And he goes, no,
I never just reordered it.
He didn't. I mean, maybe he reordered it, but so at funny. That time he just, all he could think to do was just hand him the book that he had been waiting for.
Yeah, Colin is so charming, charismatic that he compels you to do things like that.
That's yeah,
so
he really funny. Is.
And Jason's so sweet that in giving that he would do that. It's a cute, sweet story.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been
you.
A pleasure.
Thank you. This is so nice.
Have to enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Norton. Get the security you need and the speed you want with Norton Core. Go to Norton.com/Nerdist to save $30 if you pre-order before July 1st.
Hey, listeners, it's Will Arnett. Our podcast, Smartless, has crossed a milestone that seemed unfathomable when we started nearly 4 years ago, as we've just released our 200th episode. Join us as we welcome the dynamic duo of hilarity, Steve Martin and Martin Short. You've seen them on screen together in The Three Amigos, Father of the Bride 1 and 2, and most recently, and only Murders in the Building. Both are comedic geniuses in their own right, but together they are always electric. And this episode of Smartless is no exception. I don't know if I've laughed more in a single episode than this one. We discuss their career arcs both separately and as a comedy team, how they met, who is more difficult to work with, and what motivates them today. Is Steve a better banjo player than Marty as a singer? Find out on this bicentennial episode of Smartless. Follow Smartless in the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Smartless ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Plus, you get to hear Sean cry. What a loser!